Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, today I'm talking with someone who at 15 years old was living and loving the Western life in Brooklyn, New York. That is, until her father came home one day and announced he was taking the family home to live, and that home was Iran. We'll learn more about the home life and culture of Iran from a young woman's perspective, somebody who was coming of age, quite a critical time in her life, and she'll be joining us in the second half of today's show. But my first guest has, I'm very pleased to say, reinvented herself. I love these stories when people reinvent themselves at the age of 60. She is gender expert and best-selling author of 13 nonfiction books, and she's just written a new novel under the pen name Susanna Marin. She's received glowing reviews, and Between the Tides is cited as one of this summer's best reads. Susanna Marin, welcome.
Thank you for having me on. How are you, Vicki?
I am terrific today. And I said that this is a pen name, and we should say your real name. Do you want to tell us what your real name is?
My real name, right? One that's not quite as dreamy or perfect, in my opinion, is Susan Shapiro Barish. That's the name for the nonfiction, for the professor/nonfiction writer life.
Right. And, you know, some people, because I write under a pen name quite often, and people, you know, often ask, why do you write under a pen name? So tell us your reason.
Well, for me, it was really to differentiate between fiction and nonfiction. I had worked very hard on the nonfiction projects. They were always about women's lives in America. So, you know, I wrote a book on second wives. I wrote a book on female infidelity, on female rivalry, on mothering daughters, you know, how tricky that is, on mother's-in-law and daughters-in-law, of course, always a bestseller. And, you know, just the idea that we're positioned a certain way in this society. And I interviewed hundreds of women per project all across the country, different ages, social strata, ethnicity, to see really the emotional state of women in America and how at different ages we're affected differently by, you know, our roles as the girlfriend when you're in your 20s, as a mother and wife 30s, 40s, and just what women really felt versus the faces they wear. But I had actually started out hoping to be a novelist as well. I've always loved both forms. I really have. And so I kept thinking I'd get back to fiction, and finally I did.
Well,
that's the long story.
But that's an awesome story. I love stories like that. I actually know somebody who at 72, she self-published her book herself. She figured, in her words, she said, I don't think I'm going to be around long enough to find an agent and a publisher.
So I know what she's saying.
She self-published.
That's honest, right? Well, speaking of that, I was really lucky because I have a wonderful agent, St. Martin's, has for a very long time been my publisher. And I spoke with both my agent and the publisher about wanting to sort of have this foray into fiction, or, if you will, a return to the dream. And everyone was very supportive. And the one thing I can say that really guided me in creating these characters for Between the Tides was just how much I had learned by interviewing women, listening to what they really yearned for.
I think that comes across in this book. So let's talk a little about the book. It's told against the backdrop of the Selkie legend, which is very mysterious, I think, in itself. But it's also about the dark secrets of families, even those that, you know, seem to have it all laid out for them. So tell us in your own words what the book's about.
Well, the book is a contemporary novel, definitely women's fiction, and it's told in two voices, the voice of Lainey and the voice of Jess. And Lainey is the mother of four. She has 5-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, and then she has a 12-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son. Her daughter, Matilde, the 12-year-old, is definitely almost the conscience of the novel, and if you will, at the very center of it, although a big part of the book is Lainey's reconnection to Jess. Jess is the other narrator. Jess and Lainey knew each other way back in the day, and one of the compelling themes is really getting to reconnect with an old friend, and does history repeat itself, and now that they're women, not girls or young women at the Jersey Shore from many years ago, how high are the stakes? So it gets very dark.
Yeah, there's definitely some tension between them.
Yeah, there's tension.
I read that you wrote The Truth About Women and Rivalry and Toxic Friends, The Antidote for Women Stuck in Complicated Friendships. And I read that you said that the notion that women are always supportive of one another is a myth. And this is something that you explore in this book. So talk to us a little bit about that from your perspective, if you would.
Well, based on Tripping the Prom Queen, The Truth About Women and Rivalry, and Toxic Friends, two studies, recent studies, / books of mine, that really investigate why we think we're in it together, say, one day we'll say, what would I do without my female friends? And the next day we'll say, can you believe she did that to me? And therein lies the rub, right, Vicki? So the constant kind of yin and yang of it, and what do we do that's honest, and what do we do that's betrayal? And I think so much of it comes from cultural messaging. We're taught that there's not really enough pie for women in a patriarchal culture. So while there are great strides made in this country for women, at the same time, the idea that if you sit down with your best friend and she says, guess what, I'm getting, you know, a huge promotion at work and I'm relocating, you say, what about me?
Mm-hmm.
We just do. Or someone says, hi, I'm getting married, or hi, I'm getting divorced. You know, either one could be with a smile on her face, and we say, what about me? And until women stop thinking that way, we'll always think that it's a limited goods theory that pushes us forward. And in this book, because women are so clearly identified earlier, are you the it girl? Are you the popular one? Are you the wallflower, the brainy one, the athlete? So here in this story, Lainey is the dreamy outsider, and Jess has absolutely worked very hard to be the it girl.
Right. One of the other relationships, if you want to put it that way, because it does, I think, play a character part in the book, is the move that, you know, the tension between city life and living in the suburbs, which Lainey, the protagonist, struggles with. So talk to us about that.
Well, she really struggles, and we learn very early in the book, the first chapter, you know, is the inciting incident. Her husband comes home and says, this is what we're doing, because he is the breadwinner. He has the big career. And she has been, as many women with young children do, she's kind of put it to the side, although it matters to her greatly, and we see that struggle. But he's the one who comes home and says, you know, this is the move, and it's really great for the family because it's great for me. So, you know, that begs the question, well, where do we stand as wives and mothers, and how much do we lose ourselves, and what do we get to hold on to in order to really support the greater good, which is family and marriage, right?
Right, right.
And yes, you're right. I'm sorry, just to finish what you're saying. And then the dichotomy between city life, which Lainey embraces for the diversity of it, the idea that you could be invisible or you could be anything you want, mm-hmm. and it would be accepted, and a suburb, which is much more of an unidimensional sense of place and identity.
Right. She explores also the mother-daughter relationship is explored in this book. Do you have children yourself?
I do. I have three children.
And do you have daughters?
I have two daughters. And I thought a lot about my daughters when I wrote this book. And I also, I mean, you're not supposed to say one of your books is a favorite, but a book very near and dear to my heart was when I wrote the book about mothers and daughters called You're Grounded Forever. But first, let's go shopping. Because I investigated how mothers feel whether their daughters are 3 or 30, you know, and all the way through those years, in terms of and this does apply to Mathilde, my character, Lainey's daughter in the book, what do we do right and what do we do wrong in raising our daughters with such a strong gender identity?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's okay for you to say you have a favorite book. I thought for a moment you were going to say you had a favorite daughter.
No, I have two daughters and a son. I adore my children equally. What I meant was maybe not a favorite study, but a study that really resonates. And so in writing this book, as I said to you, I thought a lot about my research and listening to how women feel. You know, what we do as models, you know, as the mentor or the model for our daughters is a bit tricky. It really is. And this daughter in the novel is so connected to her mother.
She is,
so connected.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little deeper about the book and the writing of it itself and, you know, how that came together, given your background in gender experience, because I think that definitely comes through and helps you build some really strong characters in this book.
Oh, thank you.
And my guest is, this is her pen name for this particular book, Susanna Marin. The book is called Between the Tides, and you're listening to Conversations Live. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. At some point, almost all of us have had at least one great idea that we know could make the world a better place and line our pockets. But most of us get stuck in the execution of that great idea. Stanford University professor Tina Seelen can help. Her new book, Inside Out, is filled with surprising research, inspiring examples from her Stanford classroom, and real-world stories from around the globe. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150. And for past shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking with Susan Shapiro Barash, but her pen name for this book that we're talking about today is Susanna Marin. And as Susan explained in the beginning, she changed this to Susanna Marin for her fiction book because she's well known as a nonfiction book. And it does make a difference, doesn't it? Did your agent insist on you doing that?
Well, I had actually spoken with my editor a few years ago, and I said, you know, I have written fiction too, but I've put it to the side. I love both forms. That's the thing that I really do. And I said, but I'm about ready to, start really working on this novel. And I'd love to have a pen name. And she said, oh, you should.
Yeah.
She said, you know, so often for writers who write both forms or even two very different kinds of fiction, they have, they have different names. And it's I think, very nice. It feels right to me. I really like it for the book.
Yeah, I think almost everybody who has, you know, touched on different genres has at least one pen name out there. So tell us how this came together, because you were workshopping, you said, a previous novel, and tell us how that went.
Oh, yeah, this is so funny. So because we spoke before about the idea that I've been, you know, teaching gender at Marymount Manhattan all these years in the writing department, but gender has always been my topic. When I took an advanced fiction writing workshop about 5 years ago at the 92nd Street Y in New York, I live in New York, I loved the courses, and it was a great way to get back into fiction writing. So I said to my daughters one night, I said, you know, I'm going to be in a writing group for fiction. I had never done that for nonfiction with three men. And they said, three men? And I said, yeah. They said, wait a second. We were raised, we had to have female dentists, female pediatricians, female piano teacher, and because you write these books. And I said, this is different. I went for the talent. I really did. So I got into this writing group, and we were very lucky. We all ended up with book contracts eventually. This is a few years ago. I'd been in the group about 2 years, and I was bringing this novel, and I kept rewriting it. And finally, one of the guys in my group said, Susan, don't you have anything else? And I said, what? And he said, yeah, don't you have anything else to show us? And I thought, wow, maybe he's right. So I literally came back from the group meeting, looked at my cupboard of novels that I'd started, some I'd finished, screenplays, and I pulled a very kind of skeletal Between the Tides out and really started to write it. I had maybe, you know, written up an outline and had the characters, and that's what became this book. So anyone who's listening who's a writer, writing groups are great, in my opinion.
Yeah, the right writing group is great.
The right writing group. I've heard some bad stories, but I have to say, Vicki, my writing group to be writing a novel, I'm writing another novel now, has really been rewarding.
Yes, I think it's worth, if you want to go that way, it's worth spending the time to find the right group, you know.
Yeah, I was very lucky, really lucky.
Yeah, since you all got book contracts too.
And the interesting thing is, this wasn't their genre, actually, you know, commercial women's fiction, but they all appreciated the story and they liked it so much better than what I had, you know, been bringing in. So I think that, you know, the idea that three men could say, wow, this is a story to tell, was surprising and great.
Right. So I want to just ask this, and then I want to look at some of the way you structured the book as a writer, if you will. But I want to just touch on using the backdrop of the Selkie legend about enchanted seals who shed their skins to live on land as women. Did you see your character as that? Was that a metaphor?
It's a metaphor, and since we talked about Mathilde, the daughter, the 12-year-old daughter, I don't want to give the book away, but I do want to say that in the very first chapter, there's the foreshadowing. It's the idea that the mother loves water. She's an artist. Lainey is an artist, but all her art is water-themed, and she and Mathilde are great swimmers, and they love the shore. They love the shoreline. They love the waterways of New York where they live until they're moved out of New York. And so the Selkie legend is, to me, an intriguing myth of the seal women. They take off, you know, it really is a metaphor. They take off their seals, they bask in the sun, but their seal coats, but they put back on their silly skin.
Right, right. So I'm not going to give away the ending either.
Even the story, because the Selkie myth threads through it, right?
That's right. But you do say that you'd always known how the book would end. So tell us how you put this story together. Did you outline? Did you structure it? Did it freeform for you? How did that work?
Well, this is a story that, as I said before, touches on really important themes for women. You know, what do we owe ourselves? What is the journey for wife and mother? What is it about working versus non-working women that still creates tension in our culture? What is the price of freedom versus the responsibility of family? So I looked at all of that, but I knew the ending, and I know the early readers were very surprised by the ending. Someone asked me if this was a mystery. And I said, no, but, you know, you do really wonder what will happen. And that, to me, is tension. But I always knew the ending, and it really informed the story. It gave me great guidance, almost. in terms of how to bring the reader, bring the story to the end.
Right. I can see that. I remember working once on a documentary film, and I had no idea. I knew the opening and the ending, and then the middle bit had to all come together. But I could see that ending.
Right, because you knew the ending, didn't you feel that was almost a compass? Because that's how
yes,
I felt.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And my beginning was very obvious to me as well, but the whole rest of the 90 minutes was not.
that's so interesting. But you know, Vicki, there are writers who, I'm sure you know, who will say, gee, the characters guided me, or I didn't really have the plot in mind. And you asked me a moment ago if I had an outline. I did outline it, and that's actually what I uncovered in the cupboard when I came back from that writing group meeting.
Right.
I said, oh, here's an outline, and I really thought about it, and it was very clear to me. But perhaps that also comes out of writing nonfiction, where what you hand in to the publisher before you write the book is an annotated table of contents.
Yeah.
With the breakdown of the beginning, middle, and the end.
So, and one other thing you did here, which I think, you know, you did very well. I've seen it done not so well sometimes. It's definitely an art to do this. But you did bounce back between the different voices of Lainey, the main character, and Jess, the friend that she reconnected with. I'm going to use
right.
friend in
the
quotes.
The story's told in two voices, and they go back and forth. And the reason it was so obvious to me that they were so distinctive was because I think, you know, without being self-aggrandizing, I feel confident that I really understood the characters. So I agree with you. I've seen people go back and forth with voices in books, and sometimes you don't know which voice is really outstanding.
Yeah.
You know, is happening in the moment. But these two women are quite disparate.
I mean,
Jess is so socially motivated, so interested in how she's perceived and the power that it gives her in this fictive town of Elliott, the suburb, and Lainey is so much not a part of that.
Right. Well, Susanna, on your website, you have a questions for discussion for book groups. And I always like to look at those and see what the authors come up with for book groups. And one of those questions is, what is your opinion of Charles as a husband and father? And Charles, of course, is Lainey's husband and the father of Mathilde. And I'm wondering what your opinion of Charles is, because I have to say there were times when I wanted to slap him.
Right, yeah. I actually like Charles. I care about Charles, but do I see him as, I don't want to be harsh, as slightly deficient? Well, it depends. This really begs an important question. What are we looking for in husbands? Because women want husbands to be, you know, and again, this is based on my research for nonfiction. So many women want their husbands to be lovers and best friends all wrapped up in one, while the day-to-day grind of life kind of keeps that from maybe not happening every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're all pretty busy in a fast-paced society. So Charles is actually a man who adores his children. He has great respect for marriage and for family.
Right.
But is he a bit egotistical? Well, he's a surgeon, Vicki. So, you know, he has a lot of people who, you know, Lainey drops him off at the hospital. Everyone's like, one time, you know, Dr. Morris.
Right.
There's a lot of accolade
right.
in that life.
Right. Yes, I read once when I was studying sociopaths and psychopaths that there's a very high percentage of surgeons in that sociopathic.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow. But, you know, Charles is very handsome and accomplished. He takes family life seriously. So we'll give him some credit.
So did you, have you ever written as you're writing, have you ever got to a point where you think, I don't know where to go from here, or it sounds as though this book actually flowed quite well for you.
Mm-hmm. I was very lucky.
Mm.
It was the story I really wanted to tell. I think that having taught writing all these years, even, you know, really essay writing in a college, and also writing nonfiction and now writing fiction, you know, getting back to fiction, I think that the question I ask myself just personally is, what am I trying to say and what am I trying to convey? And if I ask myself that, feeling, if I'm feeling stuck or not certain, I think that if I take the time to think it through, it becomes clear.
Yeah. I want to talk about the ending, but again, we're not going to give anything away here. But it left me wondering if there's going to be a second book.
Yeah. Maybe. Someone asked me if I wanted to write Mathilde's story. Well, I'm writing another novel now for St. Martin's, but it's a very different story. But this ending, it can be interpreted different ways, correct? I mean, you would agree with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's all I'll say about it.
Okay. So I always like to ask writers, and that's probably a question that they get asked the most, but who inspires you as a writer?
Oh, I really like that question. I read everything. As I said earlier, I love nonfiction and fiction, and I love historical research and memoir. But I'm a big fan of the classics, you know, Jane Austen. I love Thomas Mann. I think that Buddenbrooks, I think he was 26 when he wrote it. Is that possible? It's just a brilliant novel. I like William Styron. I like very contemporary fiction writers, Joyce Carol Oates. And
Hannah's
the great novelist.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very interested in Dickens and Trollope because they have so much to say about their characters.
Yes.
Thank you so much, your characters.
Dickens, I mean, really, he would not have lasted this long, but I mean, he really does develop great characters.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a little too much detail for the modern reader with a short attention span.
But wasn't he paid by the word? Doesn't that tell us a lot?
I didn't know that. I knew that he started writing in debtor's prison, so... let's look at the difference between, from your perspective as a writer, from writing nonfiction to fiction. How difficult was that? Was it difficult at all? What kind of things did you have to keep in mind? Were the differences there?
Well, you know, there's that whole idea of showing and telling in fiction writing, and that there's a keen sense of balance. What do you tell the reader and what do you show the reader and what do you hope the reader will just imagine or understand, you know, just all of that threaded together. In nonfiction, you're really giving information, and your research, my research in my books from nonfiction would be interviewing women, looking at pop culture, looking at more serious treatises and really finding out how women... You know, what faces do we wear versus how we really feel? So I could take a lot of that and put it into fiction, because this is still the story of two women who really are trying to find their path. And so in that way, I would think it's not that different from reality.
Right.
But of course, it's fiction, so it's very dramatized and stakes are really raised.
Yeah. I think one of the things that makes it very real is that Lainey, you know, has really fallen into the life that she has and, you know, looking great from the outside to everyone else, but how many people do that and aren't really happy? So, I think you did that very well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's very hard for women. There's no question. And also, Jess, look at how hard Jess has had to work to be the center of the, you know, social universe in this town of Elliott.
That's right. Well,
so
we're...
I'm sorry.
I wanted to say, do you have a final word to leave with our listeners? We're right at the end of our segment here. We're having a little delay on the lag here, so we're talking over each other.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I would just like to say for those who read it, I would love to hear from them, to go on my website and get in touch. I'd love to hear from women who read the book.
And give us your website, please, Susanna.
It's Susanna, Susannah, Marin, M like Mary, Arren.com.
Okay. And, of course, Susanna Marin is the pen name for the book, Between the Tides, which is a novel, because your real name is Susan Shapiro Barish. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. And we very much appreciate you being with us today, and good luck with your novel.
Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. And please do stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Burlingame Veterinary Consulting, we cover the world of animals. This week, July 26th, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. If you've never heard Dr. Nels Rasmussen work his magic with callers and their animal friends, here's your chance. Using BEST, bioenergetic synchronization technique remotely, Dr. Nels has helped so many, he's become one of our most popular guests. Find out why on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live. And my next guest is Shagayeg Fasjani. And I hope I don't have to say that too many times because I'm going to risk messing it up. But it's a beautiful name. It is an Iranian name. My guest is a former reporter and anchor turned poet and author. And she's going to share her journey coming of age as a young woman, uprooted from all that she knew during some of the most heated years in Iran's modern history. She's traveled extensively throughout the world and returned to her hometown of New York City after publishing a collection of poetry. And she decided then to write this fiction story, The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran. Shagayeg, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And I want to just start off with you were raised in Brooklyn. Were you actually born in Brooklyn, New York?
No. So I was actually born in Tehran, and then we came to Brooklyn when I was 3 years old, and I was raised until 15 and a half in Brooklyn. But the book is a semi-fiction. It really is 90% based on real-life experiences that I've had in Iran, and it spans a one-year life of this Brooklynized Western girl that follows her father because her father is very strict and, you know, makes a unilateral decision to take her back, and spans a one-year lifespan. But I personally was taken to Iran when I was almost 16, and I was brought back when I was 22. But the book is kind of around like 17 to 20-ish in that area,
right.
17 to 18-ish.
So why write fiction and not do a memoir?
Well, there was a lot of stuff that I was privileged enough not to go through, and a lot of the other girls did go through, and I definitely wanted to incorporate it because I wanted this book to be an encyclopedia for people that really didn't know about how teenager life is in Iran, especially female teenager life, because there's a whole underground New York City in that country, especially in Tehran, which is the capital. And I really wanted to shed light on the female teenager and all the obstacles she goes through in her teenage years, which are the most difficult, I think, of any, especially in such a restrained society.
I thought that when I heard your story, you know, gosh, could there have been a worse time, you know, as a 15-year-old teenager to go back? But why were you taken back? Why did your father take you back there?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was because I was very wild and rebellious and very stubborn. And my father really, you know, he was like, I can't really control her here, so let me take her back to Iran. And the number two was that he really wanted me to get in touch with the Persian culture in Iran.
Yeah. And so you went back at 15 and a half, almost 16, you said, spent four years there. So that time presumably was in school educating. Was the school system very different to what you were used to in Brooklyn, New York?
Oh, my God, day and night. It was day and night. And I'm saying night with a K. It was completely different. It was, well, first of all, the schools are separate, similar to Catholic schools that we have here, that the girls are in one school and the boys in one.
I went to one of those schools, too.
Well, we didn't have mini skirts. We had these long coats that we had to wear. And then we had these wimples that we had to basically wear. And some of the wimples were shoulder length. Some of them went all the way down to your hips. And so that was as far as the uniform went. But then the whole school system was so different. The level of education was much, much higher than the level of education in the U.S. in their high schools. So it actually took me like a couple of marathons mentally to catch up to everybody.
Mm.
And then on the, you know, cultural aspect of it, you know, everybody loved me because I was like this alien from the United States. But the flip side was that I didn't get them initially. Like, I was all into Madonna and Bon Jovi, and I was very honest about it. You know, like on my textbook, I had like, you know, Bon Jovi's hit single Always. You know, I had that all scribbled and the lyrics, and all the girls were like, oh my gosh, so cool. But underneath all of that, they actually were the same way, but they carried a mask because you couldn't say the stuff in school. It was a school in the Islamic Republic of Iran, so you have to follow those Islamic rules still.
Right, so no Western, no music at all?
Well, of course there were music. I mean, when the principal wasn't in class, one of the girls would slip, you know, a stereo in, and we used to always, you know, do the Shakira dance. But suddenly when, you know, the people came in, we used to always, you know, sit and all act all proper and, you know, Islamic and stuff.
Right. So I'm wondering, you go, not too many schools in America make them have to wear uniforms. I had to wear a uniform, but definitely not a wimple. And I know we abused that uniform, as our headmistress would say. We shortened it too short. We undid our ties. You know, we did all kinds of things to, you know, try and individualize ourselves after school.
Right. The fun part.
Yeah. I'm wondering what it did to your sense of self, your sense of self-esteem, if anything. you know, having that drastic a change and having to be covered in this wimple?
The thing was, I was very confident. And even in Iran, when I wasn't, when I didn't know that people did stuff underground and, you know, on the surface, I felt like I wasn't accepted for who I was. I really didn't care. This is who I am. You know, I grew up in a tough neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, you know, I was a Brooklyn girl. I did what I wanted. I was stubborn. And if anybody didn't like it, they could hit the road. But it took time for me to understand that all these girls were actually on the same level that I was. And so I didn't really have a confidence issue, but I could tell you I did have an identity crisis. And that was because I didn't know, you know, I was, again, like I told you, I was very rebellious. And, you know, I want to go out with a guy. Who's going to stop me? I want to have my first boyfriend. Well, yeah, a lot of fathers are strict because they want to be protective of their daughters. But I had that, plus I had all the religious layers of the society. Like, oh, my God, if you go out, you have to be careful the religious cops don't catch you, because if they do, and if you can't pay them off, then you're going to go to prison, and oh my God. And I was like, really? We have to... So that was fun and risky, but God forbid you did get caught by those cops, which are all in the book. I put everything in the book, so what people get a feel of, you know, it's fun, but it was very risky at the same time.
Right. So you're not joking when you say religious cops. I mean, they were there to catch kids like you misbehaving.
Right, right. And it wasn't misbehaving in the sense that we were committing anything illegal. It was misbehaving that our thought process was very different.
Yeah.
And it was just a coffee shop date with a guy. And I would rather meet with a guy in a cafe than first time go to his home and not know who the guy is. So a lot of girls went the other route. In fears of getting caught, they would go to the guy's house. And that had its consequences if they fell into the wrong hands.
So even though the kids are being raised, because this is the thing, I think, that underneath all of our differences, we also have a lot of similarities. And so even though all these kids are being raised, you know, not to want to date, not to listen to Western music, it's just a natural thing in them to want to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, who wouldn't? It's all the process of life. You want to grow. You want to have fun. You want to explore.
Well, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I want to delve a little bit more into some of the cultural differences because, you know, obviously I'm English. I still go into culture shock when I go home now. It takes me a few days to get used to things again. So I can't imagine what you went through, but we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Shagayig Fasjani, and her book is called The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. At some point, almost all of us have had at least one great idea that we know could make the world a better place and line our pockets. But most of us get stuck in the execution of that great idea. Stanford University professor Tina Seelen can help. Her new book, Inside Out, is filled with surprising research, inspiring examples from her Stanford classroom, and real-world stories from around the globe. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150. And for past shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm pleased to have with us in this segment Shaga Yig Fasjani. She's the author of The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran. And she's a former reporter and anchor turned poet and author. And the book we're talking about today is fictionalized, but it's very heavily based on her own personal experiences when she was pulled out of school in Brooklyn, New York, at the age of 15 and a half, almost 16, and taken back to live in Iran for a few years. And I want to get, Shaga Yig, if we can, in this segment, I want to get a little deeper into some of the biggest cultural differences. I mean, what really was the biggest shock for you when you got there? Because as I said, you know, I've lived in Britain half my life, and uh-huh. when I go back, I still sometimes go into culture shock for a few days before I get used to it again.
Right.
And your experience was very different.
The number one shock, it was a big shocker. It was a slap in the face for me, was the religion part of it. Because I was always a proponent of, I will educate myself and I will pick that tool that gets me closer to the God. But, you know, over there, they were like, you're not getting that time. You're Muslim. You're going to pray, and you're going to fast in Ramadan. And so basically, this is an instruction booklet, and you're going to obey. And that being said, yes, they did educate us with books in school, and we did have religious education, but that was simultaneous with them telling me what to do. And I remember, and I have this in the book, that I refused to pray. I said, I don't want to pray if I don't believe in it. Let me educate myself, and if I like it, then I'll pray. And I remember they were so harsh on me that they forced me to pray, because they had, like, prayer groups. And so, like, 20 people, 20 of these females would line up, and they would pray. And I was so frustrated that I used to pray, and I used to sing Madonna songs. And I was just going up and down, doing whatever they did, and, like, mumbling the prayer when I was really mumbling, like a virgin or something like that. And right now, it was like, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I do want to believe what I feel is right.
Right.
So that was number one.
Right.
And then I got suspended, actually, afterwards. But that was okay with me. I'd rather be suspended than, you know, do something that I didn't have any belief in. And number two was the way of thinking. Oh, my God. I came from a very liberal area. For me, it was okay. Some stuff was just okay. I didn't even, like, think about hiding it or not talking about it, because people may overhear it and may judge me. And it's such a... And a lot of countries are like that when, you know, you say, don't say this because they're going to think of you like that. You know, even in France, because I used to live in Paris as well, you know, it was, even though it's a very, you know, a very famous city and very, you know, it's a crossroads of fashion, and a lot of history is in that city. It's the same way, you know, don't say this because they're going to judge you. Or the little taboo traditional things are still within Iran, and that didn't mesh well with me.
Mm. What about expectations around girls and education and careers? Because, you know, I know several Muslim women who are very, very, very highly educated. And, you know, I have to say, when I went back to England, I was staying in an area which is predominantly Muslim. And I happened to be sick at the time, and so I was in and out of pharmacies all the time. And all of the pharmacists were Muslim women.
Yeah. Oh, my God. These girls are some of the most smartest, cleverest beings I've seen. I could easily say that I was surrounded with brain power when I was in school. It's just that they were limited. I was the, you know, in the book I have it too, but in the book I have it in the form of an internship. But I was a reporter, and I was banned for going into the stadium. And I'm a very much an athlete. I play tennis, I go swim, and I love to run. And that's why I was a sport reporter in Iran, but they banned me from going inside the stadium. And that really annoyed me to the point that I said, I'm going to dress up like a guy and go into the stadium. And there's, so in answer to your question, there are so many of these limitations that girls want to be fashion designers, but there is no such course. There is not there's not a fashion design course in school. There's not a dance major in school. And so girls, you know, they do the underground way.
Right, right.
They do their work, and that's why I'm saying they're so clever, they're so smart, they just do it, and they have perseverance, they're determined, and they're enthusiastic amidst all the limitations that are set in the society.
Well, I saw on your Facebook, you'd posted something like, what does Vogue fashion look like in Tehran? And it was beautiful, it was stunning.
That was really nice. So that's one of my dear friends, and she designs, because, you know, we still have to wear these long coats and we have to wear the scarves. So they're like, okay, so if we have to wear it, let's make it fun. So she started designing all these funky, unique, long coats and scarves. And it became a fashion in itself, as you know, as opposed to the dull colors and, you know, one design. You know, some of them stick to your body, some of them cut, you know, sideways or cut. Some of them have these different fabrics. Some of them have these, like, cursive writing on it. So they made it really funky, so it's appealing to wear them now. It looks kind of sexy.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's not the norm, though, or am I wrong on that?
Well, there's different classes in Tehran, and this is more of the, what can I say, you know, a lot of people may not wear this because they're saying that, oh, this really shows the curves of the body.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be the norm, but there are a lot of people with those rebel hearts that want to have something unique, and they do it. But it's not the norm, but I could say a lot of the population wears it.
Why did you, let's do this, because in the break you said to me that those 4 years you were in Tehran, were you had some wonderful times too. So tell us about some of those wonderful times and what made them so wonderful.
Well, the period that I went back was the period post-revolution. So people had already figured out how to do stuff. So I think I went to some of the coolest parties that when I came back, because I came back and I got my other undergrad here, I went to some of the coolest underground, you know, they have an underground New York City community. The way that the guy meets a girl is not like in a bar, hey, can I buy you a drink, or I don't know, how you doing? It's not like that. It's there's a boulevard and they go around with their cars, and if a guy spots a girl, I don't know, in this, you know, a Toyota Avalon, he would chase her, and, you know, maybe the girls there know how to drive, so, you know, she would kind of go in between lanes, and the guy would go in between lanes, and then finally they would catch up, and then the guy would, you know, do this flirtatious line, and she would give back, and depending on the chemistry, he would drop his number into her car. Back in the day, there was no iPhone, so I'm sure they would do something more technologically advanced, and if the girl didn't really like the guy, she would just roll up her window and just look away as if, you know, beat it. I'm not interested.
Once you moved back to New York, were there certain elements that you missed about Iran?
Oh, absolutely. I miss the food.
Well, I've experienced a little of it myself, and it is superb. Yes.
Oh my! You want to eat your fingers.
And the people are actually very hospitable. They want you. They want to feed you, don't they?
Oh, they're so kind. And that's the second thing that I miss, is that you miss the empathy and the kindness that's in between everybody. Everybody is, they're so fun, number one. They don't take, you know, I think because it's been so hard on them, they just don't want to think about it anymore. So they're really fun. They're very kind. They're very hospitable. And some of my best friends are from that era of living in Iran, those couple of years. But none of my friends live in Iran right now. They're all spread around the world. They're all, you know, have their own companies or PhD students or so none of them are there. But I remember at the time, we really rocked it. We really had a good time.
So you wrote this book, you wrote a novel based on a lot of your own experiences, but you incorporated other people's experiences in there as well, hence the novel. But so what do you want people to take away from this experience? What do you want people to know? I guess, and what's the most common misconception that you would like to bust right now? we have about 30 seconds.
There's two things. I want people to know that, you know, these girls, these female girls, they're just unbelievably smart and clever, and it's not what the media portrays. They have no bad blood. They're very intelligent, and And I want, on the flip end, I want those girls to know that there is always light at the end of the tunnel. You know, just keep on doing what you're doing because they're just fabulous. And one takeaway is that I want, this book is an opportunity for people to educate themselves on female teenager life in Iran. And teenager life, because it circles around the same thing. And people will really get a feel of how that cultural, that portion of the society moves forward.
Right. Well, Shagayeg Fasjani, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your story with us. Very interesting. Where can people get hold of you? Website,
so my website is redlipsintehran.com.
All right. Thank you so much. We're right at the end of our segment, so we have to run out of here, but I want to thank everyone for joining us today. We'll be back next week with an all-live news show. You can find me at conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.